Hello there, colleagues, and welcome to the very first Shelby County Schools Secondary Social Studies podcast. I am the advisor for middle school, Keenan Sloan.
And I'm the advisor for high school, Brian Davis.
And we wanted to launch this little podcast as a weekly way to give teachers, building leaders, administrators a way into the social studies content and practices that we are seeing in our district as we make shifts towards new standards and new practices in general. So today, we're going to start by talking about the new SCS Social Studies IPG Addendum Walkthrough document. And Brian, why don't you talk a little bit about why we developed this?
So as we were going through buildings and doing walkthroughs during the fall semester, one of the really interesting things we noted was that building leaders are beginning to use the IPGs to start conversations, and that they were using the social studies IPG that's been downloaded from Achieve the Core to do that. And that's a great document for core actions 1, 2, and 3. But what we were finding was it's not a great conversation starter for social studies practices, especially as we move to 2019-2020, the new standards, the new practices. There are 6 new practices in the social studies standards launching in 2019-2020. They're supposed to guide our instruction, our assessment, etc. And we wanted to give guidance and conversation starters around those new practices for teaching content area social studies.
So this IPG addendum, but you know, we'll say it's a walkthrough. It's not a document that contains score numbers. This is strictly about, again, like Brian said, starting those conversations. So let's just jump right in. Each week for the next few weeks, we're going to discuss one indicator. And this discussion around one indicator at the building level could be used sort of as a look for the week. Or you guys can decide in PLCs or vertical teams or however you come together around these topics, how you want to use these in your building. So indicator A is: are students collecting data and evidence from primary sources by reading texts, examining original images, filmed documents, so that includes speeches, original media from the era in question, etc., or period-specific charts, graphs, and maps? So let's unpack that for a second, because I really think that here we have a lot of, there's traditionally, I think, a lot of confusion about what is a text in social studies.
And I'm glad you said that, because that's one of the reasons also that we designed this document, because frequently when you think of the word text, you literally think of words on paper, right? And it doesn't necessarily, in a social studies classroom, always look like that, because a map could be a text, a political cartoon could be a text, an image, a photograph. And even though it says primary sources, are there some grades where they're going to have to pull some secondary sources? In middle school, for instance, Keenan?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we're looking, I mean, so secondary sources, academic sources, you know, especially in middle school and in ancient history and world history, we're looking at eras where there is a lot less text richness, and so you're going to be needing to read other articles. We included some Newsela articles, we included some more encyclopedic articles in our curriculum, and we'll talk a little bit about those texts as we go along. But the real question is, are they being used? Not only are they being used and read by students, but are students actually collecting data? And I think that kind of gets at the heart of the issue around primary sources, because yes, absolutely, we want teachers using a variety of sources, maps, charts, etc., along with good old-fashioned printed texts. But what are students really doing with these texts? Because you don't want to fall into that cycle where you see, well, I feel like I'm going to teach this content through my lecture. Oh, and then we have to do a text.
Right. Absolutely. Because if we're presented with a text and then we've just got a series of questions, in essence, we've just done the same thing we've always done with the textbook, right? So what does it look like to collect data and evidence from primary sources? I think that's probably the key phrase to this indicator A, right?
Right, absolutely. So what we're going to talk about today and this is going to be how our podcast generally go. We're going to walk through the indicator, talk a little bit about what it looks like in practice. Then we'll talk a little bit about pacing. So we'll go through 6, 7, 8, U.S. History High School and World History High School. And then at the end, we will discuss a couple of protocols from our social studies instructional strategies appendix that we will use as research-based strategies for our classroom. So when we're talking about this indicator, collecting data, well, what is it that they're doing with it? Are they, first of all, you know, a zero absence of this would look like students are not using primary texts or secondary sources, and maybe are using only the textbook here, right? And I mean, I guess, and we've said it a lot in our curriculum about why you need these sources. But maybe, Brian, you could fill us in a little bit about the McGraw-Hill adoption and why it's so critical to use paired texts.
So the interesting thing about textbook adoption in 2014, when the current standards went live, is the current standards went live and textbook publishers only had a few weeks to make a textbook for Tennessee before it had to go up for state adoption. So the result is that oftentimes the standards correlation that they said existed for specific standards often wasn't there. And so what we're seeing is maybe a sentence or two about an entire very complex, rich standard, right? So the other thing is, in a lot of cases, for that same reason, they didn't have time to compile primary sources, especially the ones that are called for specifically in the standards. So a good use of the anchor textbook would be in places where there are those primary sources, places where there's maps, places where there's pictures, you know, teaching students to collect evidence from those sources. But we want to sort of steer clear about using the textbook as a crutch for all of the instruction, because that's not really how it was designed in this particular adoption cycle.
And so, you know, frequently you will see content in the textbook that is not necessarily well aligned with standards, and the same way with choosing primary and secondary sources, right? I mean, you want to make sure that you have alignment. So if students are reading from or answering questions about a primary or secondary source document that are in isolation and not necessarily connected to the standard or the content from the standard, that's kind of starting to emerge as using primary sources, but that's still not really what this is looking for. Even if we are sort of starting to emerge there, I feel like we risk also saying that the content and the texts listed in the curriculum are the only ones. We really tried in most cases to provide more than you need, but at the same time, there's room here for pedagogy, right?
Absolutely. You know, knowing your students and being able to differentiate and scaffold for your specific instruction, I think is really, really critical here. And so I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that it's perfectly okay to tamper with a text to meet the needs of your students.
Absolutely. I mean, because especially once we start getting into more modern texts where things are either printed in English or where there are accepted translations, you know, we have a skill set there that we're working on as a district to develop that. So we definitely want to see students reading and answering questions about primary or secondary source documents. I think that where we really start to crest into best practice is where students have access to several primary or secondary sources. So you might see the textbook, you might see a couple of paired texts, maybe with a couple of different perspectives. You know, it's great to see the primary source connected to the content. What's really great is to see multiple excerpts or multiple texts used throughout a lesson for student success, and that's really exciting to see. So that said, why don't we talk for just a second then and move on to discussing pacing and what kind of texts and strategies we should be seeing in individual classrooms. So why don't we start with sixth grade? Now, for the sake of these discussions, we are talking about week five because of the snow. In unit one of sixth grade, it's a recommended period of 4 to 5 weeks, kind of depending on the building and on the classroom itself. So as of right now, we haven't really seen anyone in sixth grade who's beyond ancient Greece, who's really ready to start Rome. So there are a lot of standards in Greece as they kind of relate to the content, and there are a lot of texts in the state standards that students are required to read.
So how many weeks is the Greek unit? It's a pretty long unit too, right?
It's between 4 and 5 weeks, so we're going to be talking about week four today as if it's week 4 and 5. So we will be talking then about the following standards. 1.6.5.6, which is describe the myths and stories of classical Greece, give examples of Greek gods, goddesses, and heroes, and events and where and how their names are still used today. Then 6.5.7 is compare and contrast the Titans with the Olympian gods and explain the surrounding Greek mythology. And 5.9 is describe the purposes and functions of the Lyceum, the Gymnasium, and the Library of Alexandria, and identify the major accomplishments of the ancient Greeks. And then it has one of those classic State of Tennessee bullet lists that has everyone from Thales down to the Parthenon. Incidentally, I'd be very, very surprised if we saw a Thales question this year on the test.
Why is that?
Well, Thales is the sort of the father of science who believed everything was made of water, and I really think that kind of obscurity would be surprising, but you never know.
You never know, because based on the blueprint, we're as likely to get a Thales question as we are to get a Socrates question.
Correct. But you'll notice, if you're looking in your curriculum maps, this week's required texts are primary sources from the Odyssey, along with an article and text set summarizing Odyssey. And then supplemental texts include excerpts from the Iliad and excerpts from Ovid's The Metamorphoses. Now, these are pretty difficult texts for sixth graders.
They sure are. Are there some suggestions you have for how teachers can really break these down with some protocols for their students?
Absolutely. So, of course, in addition to this, we have our anchor textbook. And I think we need to be clear, like when we say use the anchor textbook, that doesn't just mean, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, we want to use the textbook as a resource. So some of this indeed will still come from chapters 9 and 10 of the McGraw-Hill text. But for these, we recommend using strategies as you go, like evidence log, image analysis. We have it recommended in our curriculum map storyboard with the Greek creation mythology. That's where you're going to get those titans and gods. Town hall circle for what are the most important accomplishments. 2-minute interviews asking about these contributions of philosophers and scientists and mathematicians,
you know,
et cetera.
2-minute interviews is one of my favorite protocols that we have in the appendix strategies, but it's not one that I've seen a whole lot in our district. I think that it would be really nice to have some PLC conversations in the near future about how can we use these 2-minute interviews as really good ways for students to take ownership of the content.
Well, exactly. Take ownership of the content, check for understanding. I think it really gives you a nice intro into those into the minds of students at this point, especially. So when you see, you know, you say 6.56, 6.57, 6.59, well, we skipped 6.58 here, which is the standard about the Olympics, and it's grouped into a different place in the curriculum. But really, you know, it's important to keep in mind that we tried to group these weeks thematically so that when you're talking about the creation myths and the mythology and the culture of ancient Greece, you're getting it all in one place and you have a week in which to cover that.
One suggestion that we might have, though, also is while the Winter Olympics are going on, might be still a good time to have some of those conversations around the Olympic strategies, you know, or the Olympic standard, rather, because, you know, that really brings home the learning when they're able to watch the Olympics and see some of the events, and you can kind of talk about the differences between the original purpose of the Olympics and what it's turned into today.
Absolutely. So with that said, you know, I'll also point out that each of our weekly guidance unit pieces in the curriculum map has essential questions at the top. So this week's essential questions are, how does culture shape mythology and vice versa? And why do cultures develop philosophy? So these essential questions are high-flying that you could really apply to any of these early civilizations, but especially ancient Greece is very is sort of very concerned with these ideas. And we want to stress that essential questions aren't just something that you sort of write on the board and nod at. These can really be hooks into historical context and things like that.
Absolutely. And it's also important that you mentioned that these can apply to a variety of the earlier civilizations that we've covered, because that gives you a good hook into prior learning. Now, what did we study about philosophies and mythologies of earlier cultures, right? Yeah.
Egypt and Mesopotamia, all of those
Epic
places.
Epic of Gilgamesh.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The Egyptian Book of the Dead. All of those really great texts. And again, here we have the required text. We have some supplemental. But if you have other supplemental texts, you know, if you've been sitting on your copy of the Bullfinch mythology or the Edith Hamilton mythology and you want to bring in those excerpts or show, you know, some small video clips, however you want to bring this alive for students, you'll be able to really see that happen. But these are just your sort of hooks into the content.
And if you have a great text that you think the district should all take part in, please, please, please reach out to us. We are always looking to expand our curriculum to include new fantastic resources for everybody to enjoy.
Wonderful. Well, so let's then go ahead and move on to seventh grade. In seventh, the content that you'll be looking for this week, whether you are teaching it or observing it, we should be starting the Scientific Revolution and finishing the Renaissance and Reformation.
Good hypothesis.
So, exactly. So this first week of Scientific Revolution is actually a place where we're using standards to dovetail. And you'll notice, if you are spending time with these standards, Scientific Revolution and Enlightenment, it's really only four standards, but they're pretty packed, and there's a good opportunity here to continue with some of these Renaissance and Reformation ideas, but in this new context of the Scientific Reformation.
The interesting thing with this unit, too, is that they're not all contiguous standards. In other words, you go from 7.46 and 7.47, and then the last one is all the way over at 7.62. So, talk a little bit about how you've grouped these thematically.
Right. So because this is an introduction to the Enlightenment, where we have, first of all, our essential questions, right? What is the value of an educated society? How are revolutionary ideas born? Because this is, the text that we're reading for this week is an excerpt from Locke's Two Treatises on Government. So this is deep, difficult, complex text. And so because of that, we wanted to circle back to the previous unit to look at 7.46, so describe how humanism led to a revival of classical learning, fostered new interest in the arts, and a balance between the intellect and religious faith, and then analyze the growth and effects of new ways of disseminating information, so the ability to manufacture paper, the translation of the Bible and other books, and printing, and then our 7.62 described the accomplishment of major Enlightenment thinkers, including Locke and Montesquieu here.
As a former government teacher, I always really enjoyed the Locke and Montesquieu unit because you sort of have the ability to really synthesize two texts. And I know we're going to have a future podcast episode on synthesizing between two texts. But taking Locke and talking about you know, self-government and the value of self-government, and then balancing it with Montesquieu's sort of fear that government becomes too powerful, and being able to introduce checks and balances to students in the seventh grade, I think will be a really, really powerful civic discussion.
Well, and I think really, especially with Locke, when you have an opportunity to handle a text like this where you really get to see what the minds of the time were thinking about, you know, what is man in a state of nature, right? What are people really like? And I think this is where that conversation starts to emerge that we really see when we hit revolutionary thinkers in world history.
Especially that social contract piece, helping students understand about the unwritten agreement between the government and the people, where the people give up some of their freedom in exchange for protection, and if they're not receiving that protection, how they're supposed to, in a democracy, replace their leaders through the vote. I think it makes a really good, strong hook for talking about the importance of voting as well.
Right. So because this is the first week of Scientific Revolution and the Enlightenment, one, we have some strong TDQs in the curriculum around Locke. Now, because this is such a complex and dense passage, we highly recommend that that you use read aloud protocols, that you use Jigsaw or some way to kind of break it up. You know, maybe you have a group of very high literacy students that don't need as much scaffolding, but if you have students who are struggling with reading, they're definitely going to need some glossing and some chunking and just ways to make this text actually live for them so that they can actually answer and have access to the content. So we also have some suggested classroom strategies here, you know, alphabet brainstorming, anticipation guides, gallery walks, identity charts, found poems, and visual image analysis would all be good ways to start at, making headway into this content. And again, just a plug for the McGraw-Hill here. This is not saying, this is the only content that students need to know this week. They'll still be gathering from any sources that you bring in to your classroom that you should still be seeing the McGraw-Hill in use, but we want to make sure that students have an opportunity to grapple with this state-required text.
And the original language of the authors.
Yes, where possible. All right, so let's talk a little bit about eighth grade then. In eighth grade, we are right in the sort of middle to end, probably, of the epoch in the standards called Slavery in America, 1800 to 1850. And I think it's really important to look at this particular set of standards because this is one of the examples where the standards don't go in perfect chronological order. They kind of loop back on themselves a little bit because we're telling the story of American political life and westward expansion, but we really want to make sure that we have this concentration for this extremely important narrative and these standards that really help contextualize life in America before the Civil War. So here we have 8.64, which is describe the significance of the Northwest Ordinance and the banning of slavery in new states north of the Ohio River. And I do want to make a note here. We had a sort of an interesting time with the test question about this standard.
Yeah, the state released an eighth grade sample four-point item on this, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And in it, they imply that the importance of the Northwest Ordinance is that it was the precursor to the Bill of Rights, and it really is much, much more about slavery and slavery in the territories specifically.
And setting boundaries for how one enters the Union as a free state or a slave state, right?
Right. And so then 8.66 is the impact of various leaders of the abolitionist movement. It gives a very long list of names, so there's a whole lot of content there to look at if people want to pull in secondary sources beyond the state recommended, or even primary sources beyond the state recommended. This would be an excellent opportunity to do that, to really read the multiple perspectives of abolitionists of the era.
Especially because 8.64, like you mentioned, is really early in the timeline because it's happening late 1790s, right?
Right.
So there may be a little bit of skipping backwards in McGraw-Hill to meet that standard, right?
Right, exactly. And then finally, we have 8.71, identify the conditions of enslavement and explain how slaves adapted and resisted in their daily lives. So the essential question here, how do people fight back against systemic injustice and why are large institutions hard to change? So again, these are essential questions. They're not specifically about slavery in America, but these are the kinds of conversations that you can have around a lot of topics, but this is a very strong one here. So our required text for this week is actually the Frederick Douglass autobiography. Now, because this is a very dense, lengthy text, we've not only provided the primary source document, but we've also provided a summary to help students and classroom teachers really dig into this. So you may see the actual document itself broken up into pieces. Again, you should see students collecting evidence. You should see them looking at sort of the bigger picture here. So you could see either one of those documents, but really you should see both.
Is it okay if we're only using certain chunks of those documents?
Yes. I mean, I think that that's been a big part of the narrative that we've brought through in our discussion of how to use text in classroom. And again, I'll also point people to these text-specific and text-dependent questions. I mean, we spent some time really making sure that these were strong and robust. And taking a look at the textbook and how we can sort of synthesize this information, we really want to look as well in this particular week. Maybe a good time to call out that every week in the social studies curriculum has a writing task that is included in the curriculum. And so here, how did political and cultural leaders strike back against the institution of chattel slavery in the United States in the early and mid-1800s? Give evidence to demonstrate which efforts were the most successful in eroding the power of slavery. So here is where we have these documents in the textbook. We have the documents from Frederick Douglass. And again, here would be a good opportunity to bring in the sources that that exist here through that standard.
I think there are some in earlier weeks that might go pretty well with that question too.
Right? Yes, absolutely. And in the first semester of the text packet, we're very text heavy. In the second semester, we're really focusing on those texts that are required by the state to give a little bit of sort of pedagogical flexibility there and to make sure that, that people are getting their students where they really need them. So, so in eighth grade, again, we should be seeing those protocols. This would be a wonderful opportunity to work with cafe conversations and human timelines. You know, you could have a graffiti board in your classroom, the main question of which is how did people fight back against slavery? And you could build on that board over the course of your instructional time. So so that's 6, 7, and 8. That kind of sums up middle school. We got ancient Greece, the beginning of the scientific revolution, Age of Enlightenment, and, of course, the slavery in America. So, with all that said, let's go ahead and move on to high school. Brian, what do you got?
So, in high school, we're going to start with world history, which is traditionally taught mostly to our ninth grade students at most of our high schools. So, that piggybacks pretty well off of particularly sixth and seventh grade, since those are your world history classes in middle school, right? So, this week, we are going to be looking at the Korean War in particular. And this is sort of an odd week of study in that we're only going to be studying one standard for the entire week, which seems a little weird since there's 104, but this is really a content-dense standard with a really robust unit, a robust article set, etc. So the standard is W.62, which has described the Soviet-United States competition in Asia with particular attention to the Korean War and Vietnam War, and described the environmental changes due to carpet bombing, napalm, and Agent Orange. One of the reasons that we decided to spend an entire week on this one standard is it really has good overlap for U.S. history, because we know that there's several U.S. history standards about Vietnam and Korea, and so this is a good opportunity to go ahead and introduce students to, for instance, napalm, Agent Orange, carpet bombing. All of these are bullet statements in the U.S. history standards.
So I think that you hit on something here, which is that schools do have an opportunity when you're in those vertical team meetings with your world and U.S. history teacher. Especially, people ask us frequently, how can we better prepare for the EOC? How can our entire history department do that? There's a more obvious connection, for example, in government and in some degree econ, where those you get a lot more of the civics piece and the founding documents. But with world history, because world has to cover so much, this really is a good opportunity to see that happen. And, you know, I think that this really demonstrates an issue that we have perennially with these history standards period, is that, you know, you have 104 standards, but it's a very, very densely populated set of standards. I mean, you have long bullet lists, you have, you know, many, many semicolons separating out the various pieces. And so, you know, from as far back as elementary school, you see these massive piles of standards emerging from the state. And that's going to change a little bit in 1920, but for the sake of this unit, it's important to keep in mind that when you go in and you're seeing content and you say, oh man, they were doing Korea last week, or they were doing Korea, you know, 4 or 5 days ago, why are they still doing it? Well, there's a lot of meat there.
Well, and the great thing is it's an opportunity to be strategic in your vertical teaming, in that there are a lot of places that overlap between 9th grade world history and 11th grade U.S. history. For example, the Industrial Revolution, for example, both the World Wars, the Cold War, the modern era, and all these are great opportunities to provide valuable background knowledge so that U.S. history teachers can concentrate on continuing the work of helping students to think like historians.
Well, and I think that's probably a really good segue into your U.S. maps for this week, because we're starting to see a little bit more of that dovetailing piece. So how are things going there in U.S.?
So in U.S., this is kind of one of the more fun units, I think, because we've been slogging through the first part of the Cold War. U.S. has actually just finished the Korean War and McCarthyism, and you know, a lot of relatively depressing content, right? You know, the post-war first piece of Red Scare. And so quarter three, unit three, week one is kind of a bounce back from that. And we're going to be talking about the suburbs. We're going to be talking about the baby boom, post-war prosperity. We've got some Elvis Presley mixed in. We've got pieces of culture. We've also got the GI Bill. So there's a lot of content, and it seems kind of random strands, but it's mostly home life in the 1950s. So there's an outstanding opportunity for students to use evidence as they're looking at videos of Levittown and the birth of the suburbs. And there's also a great opportunity to use one of the protocols that we haven't really pushed as much this year, and that's one of the analysis templates specifically for analyzing sounds and music, because you've got the Elvis Presley piece, you've got some other sample songs from the 1950s, and there's an opportunity to engage in a spar debate about whether Elvis Presley was his own original musical creation or if he stole a lot of his influences from African-American culture.
So I think that, you know, we keep talking about these protocols. For anyone who's listening, if you were at DLD, you will absolutely know about these. So, you know, fast forward about 20 seconds. But all of our protocols that we're talking about here, these are research-based protocols from Facing History and ourselves. They're listed on the Facing History website, but they are also in a compiled PDF available through SharePoint, where all of the other curriculum lives. So we have all of them compiled into this nice big document, and those are available for use by teachers, and they are in every week of curriculum, no matter where you are in secondary, sixth grade all the way on up through, you know, contemporary issues. We have these protocols in the maps. And in middle school, that really reflects EL, but honestly, it reflects best practice all over. You know?
Absolutely. And I would point out with that also, all of those texts, all those videos, all those music files, everything that I mentioned for the U.S. history curriculum this week, all of those are also available in the SCS Social Studies SharePoint under 9 through 12 supporting documents. We don't want you to have to waste all your time finding all these files. We've made sure to provide quality content for you so that you can spend your time scaffolding, differentiating, planning ways to really make the learning come alive.
And so So talking back, you know, we're going to hark back here to our original point, which is letter A in our addendum walkthrough. So we've talked a lot about sources. We've talked a lot about pacing and content. But when it comes to collecting data and evidence from these sources, a question that we kind of get is, well, how do I do that? How do I do that in a meaningful way? Evidence of what? And so this week we are going to start a segment where we're going to be talking about a couple of protocols. We're going to try and pick one of our Facing History protocols each week and one of our Harvard Visible Thinking protocols from Making Thinking Visible. So for this week, to kind of go nicely with what we've been discussing, we have evidence logs. Now, you may be seeing evidence logs in your building. And if so, please reach out to us, give a shout out to those teachers, or if you're one of those teachers, we'd love to see an evidence log in action in your classroom. This is something that I have used. This is something that I know, Brian, you've used a lot in your government classes in the past.
Well, and it doesn't just have to be with analyzing documents either. Again, harking back to that idea that it could be used for an image, a speech, a video. Because I know a lot of times we as history practitioners will give our students a lengthy list of questions, and so they're worried about filling in the blank rather than really getting the meat of the content. And so over the last couple years, especially with my ninth grade world history class, I found that just giving them a compelling question or maybe two compelling questions and tell them everything that you're gathering from this video is evidence for that compelling question and how you're going to answer it really helped them watch the video with a more critical eye towards what is it that I'm supposed to be getting out of it.
And I really so for instance, I think in your unit U.S. history that we just talked about that week, talking about home life in the 50s, mm-hmm. I think that would be a really cool opportunity for everything that you're looking at that week, from political documents to advertising to music, that if you use one of those compelling questions, you could use the same evidence log. So how would you set that up? Would you kind of walk through what that would look like?
Absolutely. So we've got in the curriculum map, we've got a 7-minute excerpt called The Story of Us, and it's about the birth of the suburbs. So, you know, there's all kinds of question sets available on the internet for The Story of Us, because it's, you know, one of the bigger American history or History Channel, you know, videos. But what I found is, again, that students got bogged down a lot. So when you look at it, this is an opportunity for, you've shown that 7-minute clip, or you're getting ready to show that 7-minute clip. You've also got the text on the GI Bill of Rights. So, you know, talking about evidence and giving them a compelling question around the idea of why did home ownership become such a trend in the 1950s? How was that different from life before the 1950s? And what factors led into the growth and development of suburbs? And you could also give them something about effects of that. So you would give them the evidence log piece, which we've got in the Facing History and Ourselves part of the instructional appendix. And then you would give them whatever question it is that you're wanting them to do. Again, something probably about the growth of the suburbs and collecting evidence around that. And then at the end, when they've collected their evidence, you would have them make some kind of finished product, whether it be a short writing prompt, or you could do a gallery walk about different pieces of evidence. There's a lot of things you can do with the evidence once it's collected.
And, you know, and here, again, even if you just, if you're making an evidence log at the beginning of the week on Monday, you start with the headline, you know, what contributed to prosperity in America in the 50s? And then every document they encounter throughout that week, they're constantly adding evidence, whether it's an ad that they're looking at, whether it's GI Bill, whether it's the video, whatever it is.
We've got the 1950s Image Bank. We've got the GI Bill of Rights. There's really a lot of strong pieces that they can look at in this week's curriculum.
Also, this is a great opportunity for those schools that are doing Cornell Notes. If you're using two-column note-taking or Cornell Notes in your classroom, your Cornell Notes make a great component to an evidence log type strategy. And so we'll talk in later weeks about citing evidence and collecting evidence and the difference there. But one of the big pieces that we see, and a question that we hear, is, look, my kids are reading it. They understand the content, it seems, but how do I get them to cite evidence? You know, I don't have that much time, you know, for in-depth writing every day, and we totally understand that, but how do I get them to cite evidence? And I think, one of the things that we always come back with is this particular strategy from Harvard Visible Thinking, and it's probably my favorite one because it requires zero prep, it's high impact, and it's really quick, and that is, what makes you say that? Brian, have you used this strategy?
I have, especially in PD recently. You know, as we've talked to teachers, you know, I've found that even, you know, having adult learners, you know, explain why they say what they've said, I think that it's really, really helpful to steer students back to the text. Because frequently, we all have all this content, 112 U.S. history standards, 96 in eighth grade?
Yeah, 96
in eighth grade. Somewhere in the high 90s in eighth grade. 98. And so there's a lot of pressure on us to move very, very quickly, right? But just taking a second, and when a student gives an answer, asking them to justify the answer with what they just read is extremely powerful, not only in getting them used to citing evidence, but also in cementing the learning that they've had to go back to the text and re-justify why they've learned that piece of information.
And so we say, what makes you say that? There are other questions that you can use. What do you know? What do you see that makes you say that? Right? you know, what do you see? What do you know? All of these things really engage that knowledge, but then make the students use their content knowledge to actually answer your question. This is a wonderful protocol to pair with evidence logs. They've been taking evidence all week. As you're asking questions, they answer the questions you ask them. Hey, well, what makes you say that? They can point to that evidence log. Well, in that video that we watched, you know, it said X, Y, and Z. In that article we read, it said, well, when we read the GI Bill, one of the pieces of evidence that I collected right there, it's in front of them. They've sort of provided their own scaffolding. And the beauty of this strategy is that eventually students start to do it without the prompt.
Absolutely. And it also makes a really good build-in for accountable talk, too, because when they finish justifying, you can ask if there's anybody that has an alternate perspective. Because a lot of our primary sources have room for more than one perspective and evidence for conflicting perspectives even.
Right, exactly. So that sort of wraps up where we are for this week. We hope this is helpful. This is our very first one, so we're going to do our best to tune this to needs for content, length, and all of those other things. So thank you for bearing with us. But we hope that this will be a way that we can help teachers, leaders, and everyone who is a stakeholder in the social studies curriculum, especially since the test counts this year in middle school.
Wait, the test counts?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. If anyone asks you, the middle school test counts, the fifth grade test is live. And we want to make sure, of course, in high school that we're doing everything we can to support that live assessment. So if you have any questions in the meantime, please reach out to us via email is usually the best way. I am SloanK, S-L-O-A-N-K, at scsk12.org.
And I am DavisBC at scsk12.org.
And we will make it our every effort to make sure that there is a little sort of table of contents for this podcast so that if you are a sixth grade teacher or you're only doing eighth grade walkthroughs or you're doing world history observations this week, you know, that you can see where that portion of the podcast is. But if you have ideas for how we could improve or just questions for us, please go ahead and give us a shout, and we will look forward to hearing from you. And thank you so much for tuning in.
Thank you.